Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. For those visitors who've only come here recently, the Sangha have only just completed a rather successful and large gathering of monastics from numerous monasteries around the world. And I thought it would be fitting to to make a few notes, remarks, follow-up notes on some of the subjects that were brought up for discussion and items of interest. One talk that stood out for me was Ajahn Jayasaro gave a talk one evening about how Ajahn Chah encouraged his students to his disciples to put away their books. But what Ajahn Chah, if you study his lifestyle and the way he taught, what Ajahn Chah sought to highlight as important is to read one's heart and mind, to know one's heart and mind. I feel we have to be careful whenever we recollect the words of a teacher, what they said, even the Buddhist teaching. We had to remember that the Buddha gave various teachings according to the assembly that he was addressing, according to the audience. He gave a talk that was suitable to the time and place. And so when Ajahn Chah is quoted as saying to put away the books and to lay emphasis on getting to know, to study one's own heart and mind, be able to read one's heart and mind, to know what one's state of mind is, he's not saying you shouldn't read books, you shouldn't do a little study. And Ajahn Jayasaro continued in his talk by saying, well, it was very evident that Ajahn Chah had done some study. He seemed very knowledgeable about the suttas and the various ways of teaching that the Buddha gave. So one of the other topics that was brought up at the IEM meetings, elders meetings, was the place of sutta study. I I don't actually remember much discussion about suttas. Maybe I went to the wrong group. There is a booklet that was put together, say, 120 years ago. I thought I'd made a few notes. The Navakavada was assembled. I believe it was the prince, you know, Vajrayana Vararasa. Perhaps one of the monks could correct me if I get my information wrong, but I believe he compiled this collection of Dhamma lists that are actually a summary of various suttas. The collection of these verses, can anyone tell me? Were they around in the time, 120 years ago, or were they actually, was it this one prince, Somdet, 120 years ago, was it? Vajrayana Vararasa. Now, when we look at this collection of dhammas, of teachings, we might just see a list of qualities and, such as chanda, virya, citta, vimamsa, and just translate them in from Pali. Chanda, effort, enthusiasm, energy, and virya, the sense of quality of effort and persistence. But these lists are not so much just names that we're encouraged to remember, but actually to make part, very much part of our lifestyle as monastics. This condensed list of dhammas was put together solely for the purpose for temporary monks who come to the monastery just for one vasa, 6 months. And if you study the booklet, you'll see there is also a list formulated for the householder's practice, because the intention was that then when the monks left the monastery and they left the monk lifestyle, that they would continue their practice in the form suitable for a layperson. And that custom of the temporary ordination is still fairly alive today. It's regarded almost as a rite of passage. But having made a study myself, I noticed, and it's beneficial. It's a it's beneficial to study these dhammas because they are reminding us of what qualities that need to be abandoned and what qualities need to be developed in order to encourage us to raise the mind up, to make it fit and suitable for the work of contemplation. When I was in Thailand these last 2 or 3 years, I noticed how at the end of the, very often in the at the end of the evening chanting, we chant the verses of sharing an aspiration in Thai. And in Thai and Pali, I noticed there were 2 extra lines that don't appear in the English version. And in the English version, the last 2 lines go, was it, thus, through the power of all these, the power of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, but also then in the Thai edition, it has the Dasa Punyana Bhavena, through the power of the 10 wholesome actions. May all obstacles be overcome. So that made me curious. Oh, what are these? What are these 10? Actually, I made a start on elucidating what the 10 wholesome actions, Dasa Punyana Bhavena, in the last talk I gave here 6 months ago. But essentially, these are the actions of that lead only to wholesome results. And the first 3 are Dana Sila Bhavana, a quality of generosity, of maintaining a degree of restraint in one's conduct. And the willingness to willingness and interest in cultivating the heart and mind and then the other qualities are such as recollecting one's actions, one's own goodness. Or also the making an effort to delight in the wholesome deeds of others. When I was down in Devon during the winter retreat, and at the end of that retreat time, there was a pap bar where largely the Thai community came together to support the new Dharma Hall building program. And Venerable Suvajano came down from here to join the ceremony. And he gave a little talk in Thai, which I can remember one line in particular. and where he said, Kontai Sonjai Tambun Kana Konfarang Sonjai Kontai Konfarang Sonjai Samadhi Bhavana. So that means what he was saying was the Thai supporters are mostly seem to be interested in making merit, whereas most Western meditators they just want to develop samadhi. And then he went on, I can't remember the Thai, but I believe the English translation was really how the practice of making merit through skillful actions and the practice of meditation can really go hand in hand. They can really support each other, actually. They're not separate. They need not be separate practices. The one thing that I notice that most Western practitioners fail to appreciate, develop, and make much of is the recollection of their own innate goodness. We're so preoccupied with getting rid of our suffering, and we overlook that we really first need to understand how sukha and dukkha are conditioned, are created. By taking on moral precepts, whether we're monastics or lay people, we are making the first steps in being responsible for our actions. And if we wish to be successful in our meditation, then to learn to live consistently with a sense of restraint, taking care with how we speak, how we act, and how we relate to others in ways that avoid harming, infringing others' property rights, and we don't take what is not, we refrain from taking that which is not given. That's the standard here. In brief, we are careful. The encouragement is to be considerate in how we speak, how we relate to each other, how we act. So I say, as I think most for most Western meditators, we fail to develop that skill of recollecting our own innate goodness, and also in celebrating and taking delight in the wholesome deeds performed by others. When we chant the Anumodana, for example, at the mealtime each day, say, Anumodana is not just saying thank you, it's a genuine rejoicing in the goodness of others. One of the most important elements of the latest Sangha gathering was, I feel, what was the legacy of Ajahn Chah, and how to preserve that. I feel it's only because I've had the opportunity to go and witness, see for myself firsthand how the monasteries work in Thailand, particularly Wat Pa Phong and Wat Nana Chat. But also having visited other monasteries outside of our tradition, do I realize the value of the of the traditional forms that the senior monks like Lompo Liam and the Kruba Ajans, the senior most members of our Sangha, wish to preserve, to come to appreciate why, what it is, the quality, what it is exactly what they want to wish to preserve. At Chidhurst, there is a stone. There was a stone at the old Seema. I assume it's still there. On that stone is etched the words, "Vinay Sasana Ayu." Has anyone seen that stone? Vinay Sasana Ayu, which translates, I believe, as Vinaya is the life of the Sasana. Vinaya is are the rules which all ordained monks are expected to observe and live by. It's a code of, it's the moral code of restraint of body and speech and mind. And If we just see the Vinaya as a list of prohibitions, things we shouldn't do, then our understanding and appreciation of the Dhamma Vinaya will remain very shallow and superficial. And I've got to say for myself that little phrase, "Vinay Sasana Ayu," did seem very, just a bit too terse and dry for me to fully appreciate until I went to Thailand and just from observing how the junior monks related to the senior monks and to religious objects and of veneration, and the way they conducted themselves around the monastery, then that for me lent a different perspective, a different meaning as to what Vinaya is, because it's in the way that we live our monastic life, and that we actually live Vinaya. And it's so then Vinaya becomes much more than just a list of prohibitions, but it's actually pointing to, and the way that Ajahn Chah has interpreted and encouraged conduct in his monasteries, is he encourages beautiful conduct, not just a matter of being correct. I noticed how there's a tendency in for the Western mind, when it's confronted with rules, regulations, we tend to grasp and think, if we just do things correctly, then if we go by the word, go by the letter, then inevitably we should get good results. But there's much we can learn, I feel, by actually going to Thailand, immersing ourselves in another culture, and then seeing how these rules are actually not just put into effect, but lived in such a way that there can be deference and respect between juniors and seniors, and yet the rules are not held so tight, so rigidly, that there can also be a lightness and a genuine sense of warmth and a genuine sense of caring for each other, and a sense of wishing one each other well-being, and truly caring for a tradition that has been passed down over so many hundreds of years from the time of the Buddha. I'm not sure if I'd related this little story, but when I returned to Thailand about 2 years ago, I went to visit Wat Nana Chat, and any of you remember these two very fine paintings that they were called the Road to Mount Kailash. It was George Sharp. They used to be in the monk's vestry. There were two paintings by George Sharp, painted especially for Lumphor Samedo after his pilgrimage to Mount Kailash. And one was called The Road to Mount Kailash, and the other was called The Morning Star. Now, maybe half of you here might know the name George Sharp. And George Sharp used to be a professional artist, and he had the exceptional ability. He's still alive. I'm just talking in the past sense that he's retired, but he had the exceptional skill of painting, of being having the ability to paint in variety of styles, and he could mimic the styles of the great masters. So when you go home, you better go check that Rembrandt you've got in the back room somewhere, just to see if it is genuine. But anyway, so these paintings, The Road to Mount Kailash and The Morning Star, they were reproductions of an artist who known as Rohr. Have I pronounced that right? Any artists here who know that? Rohr, who made a tour of the Tibet and the East about, I think, in the 1880s, 1930s, more like. Richard Rohr. So Lumpur Samedo had asked for these paintings to be specially brought over to Thailand for him to enjoy, because he really missed them. Only the one thing that they overlooked was the change of conditions. The tropical damp had finally got into the canvas, and there were these blotches forming in the pictures. And I arrived just at the point when one of the monks was making a serious effort in removing one apparently annoying white patch, until I said to him, don't touch that. That, do you know what that is? That white little patch, that seemingly insignificant white little patch, it's the title of the picture. It's the Morning Star. If you rub that out, you know, Lumpur Samedo would notice. And then the painting will have to be called something else. But I quote that little anecdote because, yeah, likewise with our monastic form, we have to be careful in transplanting the tradition from Thailand to England, to Western cultures. We had to be careful not to change or to eliminate or to forget even the seemingly insignificant aspects or practices, because they may well turn out to be the most significant. And one of these, for example, is the Pindapat. It's very easy to overlook the fact that, just before Lumpur Cha went back to Thailand and left Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Kemadamo in London, they thought they were only coming here for 2 months at the time, until Ajahn Chah just happened to say, I'm leaving you here. It's easy to overlook the fact that it was the Pindapat, the practice of the Pindapat, which Ajahn Chah insisted should be maintained. He said, apparently he said to Lumpur Samedo, said, you are welcome to make alterations to maybe the way you dress. So we've got the jacket now, we didn't have before, suitable for the colder climes here. So certain forms have been adapted to our climate and culture. But he laid great emphasis on the importance of maintaining the practice of the Pindapat. Even though at the time Ajahn Sumedho had great doubt as to whether a strange Eastern tradition could be or would be sustained in such an environment. And to address Ajahn Sumedho's doubts, Ajahn Chah said something like, well, are there no good people? Are there no good people in England? So it seems very evident that Ajahn Chah, in his wisdom, he saw how monasteries or the sangha is develops organically from the goodwill of the lay people, and it's important that the monks maintain the Pindapat, because that is symbolic of our dependence or our interdependence upon the generosity and goodwill of the lay people. And so it was that one morning a certain jogger running across Hampstead Heath, upon seeing the impressive sight of Ajahn Sumedho and I think Ajahn Viradhama, maybe, he had sufficient faith at the time to offer to make over a whole 100-acre forest which he happened to own, but didn't know how to manage in West Sussex. So just an example of how a mundane, commonplace practice was a very essential element to the development of the Sangha in the West. How such a seemingly insignificant mundane practice was essential, pivotal to the what we have today. So that gave the monks the opportunity then to move out of London and to live in relatively far more suitable environment. But so I want to continue on that theme of the legacy that Ajahn Chah left for us, and how best to preserve it. I believe I have mentioned already to the community here how there was this collection of sepia prints made by Venerable Abhijñāna, and it's a book. It's a book that was put together, say, 20 years ago, and the title of the book is Dharmaroi Prabodhiñāna, and it's I believe that translates following the footsteps, following in the footsteps of Lopo Cha. And it's a very beautiful collection of sepia drawings, and maybe watercolor paintings by Venerable Abignano, who with Thai script. And I'd be very grateful if someone would take the opportunity to to summarize the meaning of the Thai script, because for me it summarizes the not just how the traditional Lumpur Ajahn Chah monastery functions and works, but also it has it conveys the spirit. The book is about the Jiwitta Prakamatan Naya Papong, which I believe translates to the lifestyle of the monks' practice in Wat Papong. So again, I say, I feel the benefit of my time in Thailand has been to actually see just how these the Wat Pa Phong monasteries function, and how the core Wat, the way of training, the way that the junior monks relate to the seniors, and the way they attend to looking after the monastery, the way they conduct themselves in the simplest acts of washing the bowl, walking in an orderly manner on Pindapat in the mornings, making an effort to be restrained in speech. And essentially cultivating beautiful conduct, and so that so then at the end of the day, then one can, when we make an effort to order our lives in such a way, then at the end of the day, this is something we can reflect upon, having made an effort. One can feel good about, or one should feel good about having made a wholesome effort. So I feel it's important not just to have ideas, not just to study the Dhamma, but to realize, to remember that as monastics we are participating in preserving the living form of the Dhamma and Vinaya. So then, in that way, we are connecting directly to how the monks lived, even in the time of the Buddha. There is a place where place in the suttas whereby I believe it was after the Buddha came out of solitude after having spent a vasa away from the was at the Kosambi monks, where the Sangha fell into disharmony, disorder over some minor rules. And on his way back to the monastery, he happened to meet five Arahant monks, and he asked, "Oh, how did they live? How did they conduct themselves day to day?" And then the sutta goes on and talks about how one monk would remain behind, and the four monks would go on Pindapat, and the monk who remained behind, he'd attend to preparing the seats, and then once the monks have come back from Pindapat and eaten their food, and then together in harmony, in silence, in harmony, they would clear, and the junior monk would serve the senior monks in washing the bowl and then putting the vihara into order, and then they would spend the remaining time in contemplation. And this was a model of harmony. There are also various factors that we need to bring to mind, to recollect, even before we come to sit down to meditate. And these are sometimes called the four protective meditations. In their traditional form, we talk about recollecting the qualities of the Buddha, but I also feel it's helpful to remember that, particularly for us as Western practitioners, that we should not overlook the quality of faith we have. Should be very much a part of our bhavana. Now, faith is something that tends to come naturally to Thais and those from Asia. That faith is—I'm talking about, say, the confidence that there was such a person as the Buddha who lived for the benefit of the many folk, who actually did realize the truth, did actually discover the path that leads away from these patterns, these unsatisfactory ways of living, of thinking, of acting. Someone who knew what was beneficial. So one of the practices is to recollect the qualities of the Buddha. But really, that's reminding ourselves of the faith that we have that there was such a person. The other quality to recollect is that of metta. To remember what the intention of our endeavors in meditation is. It is to develop the skillful, beneficial qualities of mind. We shouldn't just wait until our mind is overcome by aversion to start developing metta. Really, that's too late. It's to recollect, to make an effort to develop metta, a quality of well-being for oneself as well as others, is to set the mind uprightly to move in the right direction. Also, it's very much part of, say, establishing a wholesome intention to developing the mind suffused with the qualities of harmlessness, of restraint. I'm just thinking of just a good way of rounding off this talk, and I wanted to. My intention earlier this evening was actually to leave you with this one verse that I find quite inspiring to read to myself from time to time. It's from Dhammapada 178, and I've seen various renditions of this. It's about the first stage of sainthood. It's that most of us know as stream entry, and I've seen various interpretations of this Dhammapada verse that I've written out the one that I find the most inspiring, the most moving, and that is this. Greater than sovereignty over the earth, better than going to heaven, greater even than lordship over all the worlds, is the entry to the stream. Greater than sovereignty over the earth, better than going to heaven, greater even than lordship over all the worlds, is the entry to the stream. And so if you're interested in getting your foot on the ladder of sainthood and making significant progress in this lifetime, well, we need to know what qualities we to be cherished, to be developed, and one of these is an unshakable faith in the Triple Gem, and the other is the establishment of virtuous conduct, living in a way that's consistent with the Dhamma Vinaya, living in a way that is considerate, having a livelihood which is harmless, that's not exploitive. And then the other quality is one of generosity, to be able to be willing to not just read about, to study, but to live, to practice Dhamma, and to be able to help others, to give help in time of need, Sometimes generosity is seen entirely as dana, and dana is what we have at the mealtime every day, but it arises from a heart of generosity, a heart that is suffused with dana. So generosity indeed arises first from that a heart that's willing to offer help in time of need, and this is not just to monks or monasteries, but to people we meet in very ordinary day-to-day circumstances. So my time is running out, but I sought to highlight the place, the purpose, the function of the summarized Dhamma lists, as in the Navaka Vada. It's a book, a little booklet that can be of benefit to monastics and lay people. It really is a summary of what qualities we need to take an interest in to develop, and also those qualities that need to be relinquished and abandoned if we have a genuine wish to make progress on the path.